today, why believers can be weak, humble, and grateful in a culture of power, pride, and self-sufficiency.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Before I start into today's scripture, and it is a show where we will focus on one passage today, the 18th Psalm, but before I jump into that, I need to mention something from the previous show. This is at Daisy's demand, which is, she produces the show, which is that she actually uploaded my dissertation to the website so that you can access it, barrycreamer.com, if you want to go there. You're also welcome to go there anytime. Obviously, if you get the podcast from the place you listen to podcasts, you may not ever see our website. There are also devotionals there and stuff like that. But if you wanted to access my dissertation because you have insomnia and looking for some solution or something like that, you feel free. I referenced it in last week's show. But today, we're doing the 18th Psalm. As I myself am working through the Psalms, I'm not always bringing those to the episodes, but this one seems particularly appropriate for the very reason that I mentioned a moment ago, that the requirements of this psalm, the nature of this psalm, really does speak to something that should change the way we think about our relationship with the world around us. And it's such a prominent psalm. It's present twice in Scripture. Once as this, the 18th Psalm, but the other time as the 22nd chapter in 2 Samuel, when in the historical account, David gives us the Psalm for the first time in its context. And that actually helps us to understand what's going on in the Psalm. The caption that's given to us at the very beginning of the Psalm, which is part of the text, this happens in a lot of the Psalms. There's a little line at the beginning, a Psalm of David or something like that. In this case, it mentions that it's a Psalm of David, but it's making the point about some historical information that we might misunderstand if we didn't get the context of what's going on. So I want to mention that first, and then we're just going to read through the Psalm. And it's a long Psalm, so I'm warning you now, it's 50 verses long. That doesn't mean it has to be a long episode. So you may doubt my ability to manage the time on this, but I think we can get there because you will be familiar with a lot of it, and the most prominent features of the psalm are fairly straightforward once you see them. So I think we can manage this. So here's how it goes. It starts before verse 1, and yet in the text, with a statement to the choir master, a psalm of David. And by the way, from this point forward, just from that word, from David forward, it is identical with the exception of a word or two, which would have simply meant that by the time it got to the Psalms, the book of the Psalms to record for us under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, of course, it had been adjusted with just one or two words, but nothing of content changes. Verse by verse, one verse off, because they actually do count this as verse 1 in 2 Samuel 22, the passages are identical, which tells us how important this was in any assessment of how the canon comes together. Because Israel considered it so important, because the Holy Spirit considers it so important, whatever the point, it is repeated for us so that we have to pay attention to it. This is the Davidic psalm. This is the one that is which is David's response to what's happened in his life. And so here's the statement. To the choir master, a psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, who addressed the words of this song to the Lord on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. And because it says from the hand of Saul, I think we're thinking, oh, well, as soon as he's out of Ziklag, and as soon as Saul falls on his sword and Jonathan's no longer a rival for the throne, as if he was a rival instead of a friend, we just think, oh, well, they must be talking about that time period. But it's not. David doesn't give us the psalm in response to Saul's death. That's a part of it, but it's delivered from Saul's hand entirely. And there's a lot more to that than simply Saul chasing David around the mountain until Saul himself is dead, because this, we know that this is written after Absalom's death. We know this is written after the rebellions that take place even after that, and when David is firmly established on the throne, after all of Saul's household is finally put into a position of submission to the authority that David has on his throne. He's already, and just to give a little more context to it, so you'll remember how much has transpired after Saul's death and before David writes or gives us this psalm in 2 Samuel 22, but here we're reading it in Psalm 18. He's already left Jerusalem being pursued by Absalom to be killed out in the woods, which is very important for the prayer, for the response, for David's praising of God for the power that he has later in this psalm. It's definitely part of the picture of what's going on, is that this is David saying, God protected me when Absalom wanted to kill me out in the woods outside of Jerusalem. And so remember, when he's leaving Jerusalem, Shimei confronts him, because Shimei, part of Benjamin, part of Saul's extended family, that clan, he says David is unjustly the king, and he's throwing rocks at him or throwing dirt at him. And remember, David's men want to kill him, and David says, no, we're not going to do that. God is chasing me out of Jerusalem. I'm certainly not going to punish a person who's threatening me. But he's threatening him because he wanted Saul's family to be on the throne. That's always a part of the picture. When David is returning to Jerusalem after Absalom's death, and he meets Mephibosheth and Ziba, and there's been this controversy about whether Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, was being loyal to David or not, because David had protected him because of Jonathan, his love for Jonathan. And it looks like Mephibosheth hasn't been loyal to him, and yet David protects him in some ways, parts the estate with Ziba at the same time, all making the point that David is being pretty generous in light of the threat to his throne that Saul's family is still making, his extended family. And it finally comes to a conclusion when David realizes that the land is barren and under the curse of God. We've been told this since Deuteronomy, that when the land doesn't have rain, and by the way, this is how the King Arthur tales are told, this is the reason for the title The Wasteland in T.S. Eliot's poem, all of that comes from this identification of a land with its king and the king with the people overall, so that when God is cursing the land, it's evidence that he's cursed the king and he's cursing the people. And when David says, why are you cursing us? Why are you not giving rain? Why are we in this drought? This is after all of these rebellions have taken place. After all of that has happened, the Lord says to him, well, because you, and he's referring to Israel as a whole, but he's saying you, Saul, had violated, and he's saying this to David, but I'm saying Saul is the one who violated the treaty, and David is accountable for it, and the people of Israel. There's a lesson in there for another day, but anyway, the point is, David says, what's going on? And he says, because you've been violating your covenant with the Gibeonites, these Amorites who had sort of tricked them into making a treaty that God didn't even want them to make, but once they made it, he expected them to keep it, and they didn't. And so David does this terrible thing in handing over some of the descendants, Saul's grandchildren, to the Gibeonites to be murdered, to be slaughtered. And then the land has this recovery. And in all of this, Sheba is mounting a rebellion, as the other tribes of Israel, in the same way that that Rehoboam and Jeroboam have this conflict two generations later. That same thing is going on in David's day, because the throne is not secure from all of those who would rather have had Saul as their king than David as their king. That's always going on in David's reign. And while all of that is happening, he's encountering these conflicts and these rebellions and these uprisings and resistance and even this famine in the land. And when it's finally done, he writes this psalm to say now he's been delivered from the hand of all of his enemies and from the hand of Saul. That's where this psalm comes in. So this is really David's broad statement about his whole throne, life, blessings from God, how the kingdom has been established, to say this is what Yahweh is able to do in the end. And so we arrive finally at verse 1, and you say to yourself, 50 verses, and you think you'll be done. I think we can get there one time through. So starting in verse 1, and we'll just go through verse 3 on this, he's simply declaring that he calls out to Yahweh in this statement. I love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call upon Yahweh, I call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. So in this desperate condition where I find myself, I call out to Yahweh for help. And we see David doing that repeatedly, and he has a need to do it repeatedly because he's in a desperate situation a lot when he's running around the opposite side of the mountain from Saul or when he's hiding outside of Jerusalem from Absalom. He's having to call on the Lord to protect him. And it's the Lord who is his rock, fortress, deliverer, in whom he takes refuge, and so on. So you get the idea. Now, this is just the declaration in the first three verses that he calls out to Yahweh for help. The amazing thing is that while David is in this world and in this insignificant position, he calls out for help, and there is a response. Yahweh receives me. Yahweh takes me in. And this would be enough to make an entire psalm. So in the next verses, down through 20-something in the verses, all of it is simply going to be Yahweh receiving this request from David and handling the need that David has in this crisis. So first, here's the picture that he gives. So David is calling out to him as a strength, a rock, a fortress, a deliverer, and so on, and here's how he describes it. Here's where I am, David, in verse 4. The cords of death have encompassed me. So I am already bound in the grave. I am ready to be buried, or I am under the ground. I am in an unsafe place. But I certainly can't reach heaven. There's no way I can escape the bounds of this world. So I'm trapped here. The cords of death have encompassed me. The torrents of destruction assailed me. The cords of Hades, Sheol, entangled me. The snares of death confronted me. So I'm trapped. I am pinned in the woods. My foot is stuck in a trap, and I can't get out of it. So there's no way I can get to the temple. I can't go to God to offer a sacrifice. I can't arrive at his throne room to ask for help. But in my distress, while I am bound to the world, while I am stuck in this grave, in my distress, I called upon the Lord, this is in verse 6, to my God, he called on Yahweh, to my God I cried for help, and from his temple he heard my voice, and my cry to him reached his ears. From this man who is stuck, where I've heard people say it before, that they're praying and they feel like their prayers are bouncing off the ceiling. This is what David is describing. Stuck in a room with an iron ceiling where there's no way that my prayers could enter into the throne room of God. The ant calling out from the railroad track, to use the old metaphor. In that voice, I cried out to God so that nobody would have heard anyway. No one else in this world would have heard. And God sealed up in this temple of holiness where no one can approach him. As the exalted, remote, transcendent, distant God, Yahweh, from that temple of holiness, heard my voice. He heard me. And my cry to him reached his ears. So here God listens to the cry that David gives from this world. Starting in verse 7 now, we get an idea of who it is that responds, and the description of who it is that responds is no longer remote and transcendent and exalted and distant, but that God who is all of those things, that God who is all of those things is also the creator. And I'll explain why I'm referring to him as the creator in just a moment, but the point is that he's not just transcendent, he is also immanent. He also comes into this world and makes contact with it, and not just makes contact with it, but owns the whole thing. So starting in verse 7, and if you are looking at it, you'll notice this with me, that in verse 7, it's talking about the earth. In verse 9, the heavens. And finally, by verse 15, it's the sea. So the heavens and the earth and the sea, those things, those three things are always the characterization given of the whole of creation from top to bottom. And there are times, he does this once in Psalm 8, there are times when he will start at the middle because that's where we are, and then look out from there. So we start with the earth where we are, and then we go up to the heavens, and then we go down to the sea. Other times, he'll start at the top and go to the bottom, from the heavens to the earth to the sea and all that is in them, and so on, the language that's used in several places in the Old Testament. So here, he starts with the earth, then the earth. So I've called out to God from my weak position and my trap where I have no hope whatsoever, and I don't even expect the transcendent God to hear me because I don't deserve to be heard, and I'm so weak, and he's so holy, I can't approach him, and yet he has heard my cry. That holy God who is so transcendent, will he respond? I don't. When I called out, the earth itself reeled and rocked. The foundations also of the mountains trembled and quaked because he was angry. So it's not just things are happening in the earth. God is angry and responding, and he is shaking the earth in response to my cry. And you can hear where this is going. He's going to be saying, I am trapped in the underworld. I am bound. I am encompassed by the bonds of death itself. So I am trapped in the underworld, and God has heard me from his temple and is going to move heaven and earth to respond to my need. So the earth reeled and rocked. The foundations also of the mountains trembled and quaked. And this becomes a description of a volcano, you'll see. But it's not intended to be a reference to an actual volcano. It'd be fine if it was. But they know how to look at that. They know what it looks like to see a volcano. And so he's using a metaphor to say, if I could describe God in terms of the earth, he would be the volcano. And so in this personification of God's action on David's part to move the earth, he said, have you seen a volcano? That's the best description I can give you of how profoundly and powerfully the Lord responded to my prayer. And so he says, smoke went up from his nostrils. After he said that the mountains were trembling and quaking because of his anger, smoke went up from his nostrils, devouring fire went up from his breath, glowing coals flamed forth from him. Then he moves to the heavens above. And remember, he has experienced just before this, in 2 Samuel 22, we get the psalm recorded as well. And just above that is where David is experiencing the drought, the famine, where he has to pray to God to bring rain. And God finally blesses them with rain when he makes things right with the Gibeonites about that treaty. And so in God sending the rain, this is David saying, God has responded to my prayer by moving the heavens. So see how he describes it in the psalm in verse 9. He bowed the heavens and came down. Thick darkness, as he describes these cumulonimbus clouds, you know, that are roiling up into a storm. Thick darkness was under his feet, and he rode on a cherub and flew. He came swiftly on the wings of the wind. He made darkness, imagine these thick, dark clouds bringing the rain. He made darkness his covering, his canopy around him, thick clouds, dark with water. This from the man who is experiencing drought until he called out to God, who delivered him through the rain. Out of the brightness before him, hailstones and coals of fire broke through his clouds. The Lord also thundered in the heavens, and the Most High uttered his voice, hailstones and coals of fire. He sent out arrows and scattered them. He flashed forth lightnings and routed them. So now this storm has come as God's response to David's need. It's not gently responding. It is God soaking the earth again to renew the covenant with his people, just like he does with Elijah on Mount Carmel. But in verse 15, David then takes it to the sea itself. Remember, he was trapped, and in their cosmology, the heavens, the earth, the sea is the underneath. It is in later psalms that come just after this one, it is the foundations of the earth. God laid the foundations of the earth on the sea and on the rivers. And so as he describes the waters, he's describing where he was trapped, where he was lost, where he needed hope, metaphorically. And so in verse 15, he says, then the channels of the sea. So the openings in the sea, the channels of the sea were seen, and the foundations of the world were laid bare at your rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of the breath. And we think back to the Red Sea or the Jordan River where they crossed over on dry land. And David is saying, I was being submerged in this deluge of despair, and you parted the waters, and the foundation of the earth was seen, and I just walked out on dry land. That's what the Lord does for him. Or Lord, at the blast of the breath of your nostrils. And then he summarizes all of that in a single verse by saying, he sent from on high, the heavens above, and took me on the earth and drew me out of many waters. So in one verse, verse 16, he reemphasizes, he recapitulates what he just described for us God doing. And then in verse 17, talks about where I'm left now that God has moved the heavens and earth to respond to me. Where does he leave me in this world? Am I just dropped somewhere in the same dangerous place I was before? So he starts in verse 17 and says, he rescued me from my strong enemy and from those who hated me, for they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity. These are all of those enemies, one after another, whether it's Absalom's army that he's gathered or Saul's army that was chasing him around the wilderness. It's all of his enemies. He said, no, they confronted me in the day of my calamity, but Yahweh was my support. He brought me out into a broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. And a broad place is always how you describe the place of safety. No matter where you turn, no matter where you go, you're in a secure footing, and the choices are good. You know, this is the opposite of the slippery place on the side of the mountain where one misstep sends you off into perdition forever. And so in verse 19, he brought me into a broad place, and he rescued me. But he doesn't just describe God in that sort of two-sided role of the transcendent God who, remarkably, from his temple is willing to hear my voice, but also who created the heavens, the earth, and the sea, and all that's in them, and moves all of that creation in response to my need. He's not only transcendent, immanent in contrast, but he's also and this is in contrast to simply being the creator, the one for whom you would describe the heavens and the earth and the sea. Beyond being the creator, he is the judge. He didn't just create the world and turn his back on it. He didn't create the world and leave it to run. He created the world and has expectations for it, and he oversees the fulfillment of those expectations as the judge. And this section, this is very important, starts in verse 20, goes down through verse 27, and then we move on to the next section, beyond where David has simply called out for help because he has a need, and God has responded. God responded, even though he's transcendent and holy, God responded because he's the creator. Now God is going to respond because he's the judge, and then we'll move on. But God as the judge responding to David should be terrifying, because this is after Bathsheba. Remember, all the things that happened with Absalom's rebellion come as a consequence of what happens with Bathsheba and the transition of David into this mimicry of Saul and his kingdom, because David is no better than Saul by this point. And if you say, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. No, that is the point. David is the chosen one, but he's not chosen because of his self-righteousness. He is anything but that. And yet, listen to his words, starting in verse 20. This is after all of these episodes, including Bathsheba. The Lord dealt with me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands, he rewarded me. What on earth can he mean by righteousness and the cleanness of my hands? Because I have kept the ways of the Lord. I don't think the ways of the Lord are supposed to include murder. So why is he saying that? For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God. But listen, he clarifies exactly what he means, and not hedging it, not compromising it, but acknowledging the reality of where his righteousness comes from, where his clean hands come from. And if we were studying Psalm 51, the one you're familiar with, his repentance from Bathsheba, then you would remember the end of that psalm, the real sacrifices of God and the things God actually demands from us. And this is the broken and contrite spirit, right? That's the passage I'm talking about in Psalm 51. Here he gets to that in these verses, verse 22. For all his rules were before me, and his statutes I didn't put away from me. I was blameless before him. I kept myself from guilt. In what possible way? So the Lord has, he repeats it, rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in his sight. And then what does it mean to be righteous? What does it mean to have clean hands? Starting in verse 25, with the merciful, you will show yourself merciful. This is a theme repeated not only in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament as well, in the book of James, for example. So it shows up all of the time. With the merciful, you will show yourself merciful. With the blameless man, you show yourself blameless. With the purified, you show yourself pure. With the crooked, you make yourself tortuous, crooked. For you save a humble people, but the haughty eyes you bring down. It's in David's contrition, humility, repentance, his coming before God and knowing that only in the mercy of God does he find his rescue, that he describes his own righteousness and cleanness of hands. I'm not hiding it from God anymore. My hands are clean because I have brought them up to God and he has washed them in his mercy and in his power then delivered me from those who are against me. And his statements of the power of God delivering him are followed by these statements that that power was expressed as mercy on somebody who had been guilty and needed the mercy of God to respond to him. This is Yahweh as judge. And there are a lot of passages where this happens in the Old Testament that just after he is described as the creator, he is then described as the judge. The way we think of that in the New Testament or in some of our hymns is when we say the words, he is creator and sustainer. That's the point of it, that God not only creates the world and then leaves it to run, but God stays here. So that when we're saying, how could a good God allow a world to operate like this? God has come into this world because it is such a mess. God has come into the world because we disobeyed him, but he did not come into the world bearing his sword and crushing in the grape vat. He came instead as the one expressing mercy. The world was already judged. The world was already condemned. So he sent one to save, to deliver, to heal the world. And that's what he's doing with David here as well. So that's through verse 27. Then there's this pivotal passage right in the middle. And you can see that we're going to make this. Come on, have some confidence. So he takes this pivot in verses 28 through 30, where light infiltrates the darkness, where the possible overtakes the impossible, where there is shelter to be found out in the open. And think of this as David out in the open in the woods running from Absalom and yet finding shelter in God and being perfectly safe. So he says in verse 28, it is you who light my lamp. The Lord my God lightens my darkness. For by you, he says in the second metaphor, I can run against a troop. If you are an individual and you find an entire legion of soldiers against you on the other side, then you don't go there. You can't get past them, but he can. By you, I can run against a troop. By my God, in fact, we describe it this way. We say, I ran into a brick wall. He is saying, I ran into a brick wall, but this is how he says it. By my God, I can leap over a wall. So I came against a wall that I shouldn't have been able to get past, and I called out to the Lord, and I just leaped over the wall. Now I'm not stuck behind the wall anymore. Again, this is the pivot in the psalm, and I'll talk about what he pivots to in just a moment. And then he finally says it this way, this God, his way is complete. It's perfect. The word of the Lord proves true. He is a shield for all those who take refuge in him. So that when I don't have a shield, when I don't have refuge, I have a shield and I have refuge because I have Yahweh. And so this pivot actually takes us from being a person who's in desperation and need and calling out to God and finding rescue. So he delivers us. That's fine. It takes me from that to a person who has now leapt over the wall with a light for my path. And now I'm being sent by God to do something. I'm not running from things anymore. If anybody's going to be running, it's the people who are in my way because God is now sending me to accomplish what he's called me to do. So starting in verse 31, it's obvious for David. I mean, he spent his entire early life running from things and yet seeing God deliver him and then turn it into the very means by which he sees these unbelievable accomplishments, successes, conquests. And that's from the bear and the lion to Goliath, all the way past Absalom's tragic loss to sitting on the throne now and saying, God has established this and proven that it is his work, and now I'm going to pursue it. How does he pursue it, and where does God send him that he wouldn't have gone on his own? Well, here first, Yahweh gives the direction to him and then the power to accomplish that thing. It's as if he says, not only did he let me leap over the wall, but he carved out a path for me, lit it, and said, go that way, and then gave me the power and the strength to do it. So who is God but Yahweh? This is verse 31. Who is a rock except our God? The God who equipped me with strength and made me blameless. He made my feet like the feet of a deer. He set me secure on the heights. He trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. And if you hear this and think, oh yeah, great, we're going to go destroy those politicians on the opposite side of the aisle. We're going to go defeat those people on the opposite side of the culture war. You're missing the whole point of how we ought to be reading this conquest from David, at least based on how Paul says we should take things like this. I'll give it to you in just a moment, but you can hear, can't you already? I mean, he's taking up this bow, the weapons of warfare. Aren't you hearing Paul in Ephesians 6 talking about our panoply, talking about the shielding, the protection, and the equipment that God gives us so that we can fight our warfare? I'll read some of that for you in just a moment. In verse 35, he says, you have given me, David says in Psalm 18, you have given me the shield of your salvation, and your right hand supported me, and your gentleness made me great. You gave me a wide place for my steps under me. He has said this twice. You give me a wide place for my steps. And when he's not focused on the fact that the place is wide, he says, you've given me the feet of a goat. So that even if I'm in a place where others would think it's dangerous, it's nothing to me. I can dance around on it, and I can leap like a deer. I have this power because you gave it to me. You've given me a wide place for my steps under me, and my feet did not slip. Now, remember, if you're thinking this means, all right, I'm equipped. I'm going to go take on those dirty pagans in this culture. I'm going to go defeat those wicked people who are driving our country into the ground. I just want you to pause and remember how Paul says believers ought to think of terms like this. Put on the whole armor of God, he says. You know the passage. You know it like the back of your hand. Put on the whole armor of God so that you can be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. I just don't know how many ways we can say that to make it any clearer than what it says. People are not our enemy. And to the extent we make people our enemy, we are ignoring the whole point and message of the New Testament and what God does for us, which I'll come back to in just a moment. We don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. And again, it was not an accident. You can go back and listen to the episode about David and Absalom. It was not an accident that David is crying out in agony over the death of the man who was trying to kill him, chasing him out of Jerusalem, his son Absalom. And so we are opposing spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God so that you can be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm. That language is not accidental. This is what David is talking about. You've given me your armor, and you've allowed me to stand firm in a broad place with the feet of a goat so that I never slip. I am secure because you have not only rescued me from my desperate need, but I'm no longer simply trying to hunker down and protect myself. I'm no longer pulling out my weapons to defend myself. I've leapt over the wall. I've run against a troop. I am equipped by God to pursue the path that he's laid in front of me, and it's the enemies who ought to be terrified right now, because it's God who's equipping me to pursue his will. And by the way, to finish that passage out in Ephesians 6, what exactly does Paul say he's finally been equipped to do so that this power can be fully manifested in him? He says, to that end, keep alert with all perseverance, making supplication for all the saints and also for me, that words may be given to me in opening my mouth boldly to proclaim the mystery of the gospel. And in Ephesians, there is no confusion about the mystery of the gospel, that people who were formerly our enemies are now part of the family of God. That is not a mystery of the gospel. That's the mystery of the gospel. Go back and look at it in Ephesians 3, and you'll see what I'm talking about, if you choose to read the Bible in Ephesians 3, as I've requested. Anyway, here's the point. So here's where we are so far. We've had this pivot, and now God has sent me on a mission and equipped me. So I'm not hiding in the woods with nothing. I am fully equipped, not with the armor that everybody else has, but with Yahweh. He is my shelter. He is my refuge. Remember, that's how the psalm began to begin with. Now we're starting into verse 37, which, by the way, stand in contrast to verses 16 through 19 at the beginning of the psalm. So in verses 37 through 42, we're going to be talking about the victory he gives me over my enemies. And in 16 through 19, we saw him delivering David from his enemies. So he rescued me from my strong enemy. Here's David going against his enemies. And look what happens. I pursued my enemies and overtook them, and did not turn back till they were consumed. Remember, the opening of the psalm, he's being pursued by his enemies, and he's praying to Yahweh to be delivered from them. Now he's pursuing his enemies, and he overtakes them. And I did not, he says, turn back until they were consumed. I thrust them through so that they were not able to rise, and they fell under my feet, because you equipped me with strength for the battle. Again, put it in the context of Ephesians 6. And you made those who rise against me sink under me. You made my enemies turn their backs to me. And those who hated me I destroyed. They cried for help. Who else cried for help in the psalm? David. David cried for help, and God rescued him. I have called out to the Lord for help, and the Lord is my fortress, my rock, my strength, my refuge, and so on. They cried for help, but there was none to save. In fact, if you go back to verse 6, in my distress, I called upon the Lord. To my God, I cried for help. From his temple, he heard my cry. My cry reached his ears. They cried in verse 41 for help, but there was none to save. This is Mount Carmel. This is, I'm not saying it's literally happening on Mount Carmel. Obviously, that's generations to follow. But the point is, it's a repeat of exactly the same lesson. It's what we ought to see when it's on Mount Carmel. Elijah calls out to God, and God responds to him. All the prophets of Baal call out to their gods. They cut themselves. They are enthused. They repeat themselves in the way Jesus says we should not do like the pagans. They repeat themselves, thinking they'll be heard for their much speaking, and they get nothing. Elijah mocks them for their prayers. That's what David is doing here. I called out to Yahweh, and from a grave, bound to the earth with no voice that should have been heard, Yahweh in a locked holy temple heard my voice and shook heaven and earth to respond. They cry out to their false gods for help, and there's nobody there. So there's no deliverance. This is exactly the opposite of what was happening at the beginning of the psalm. Verse 42, I beat them fine as dust before the wind. I cast them out like the mire of the street. You gave me a broad place to stand. You made them the slippery place where others stand. That's how far removed the enemies of God are from his people. Starting in verse 43, you delivered me from strife, and this is Yahweh exalting David so much that where he was running from his own throne room before, being pursued by Absalom, now he is being made a ruler on a throne over other nations. You delivered me from strife with the people. You made me the head of the nations. People whom I had not known served me. As soon as they heard of me, they obeyed me. Foreigners came cringing to me. Foreigners lost heart and came trembling out of their fortresses. Yahweh, my rock, my shield, my strength, my fortress, I hide in him. These were hiding, and once you put me on the throne, they knew they had nowhere to hide. And they came out cringing for mercy from me. And who do I thank for that? Yahweh. And so now I would compare this with verses 1 through 3, going back to the beginning of the psalm where he talks about how much he loves the Lord. Now we understand why he's able to say that. And so he says, the Lord lives, blessed be my rock, exalted be the God of my salvation, the God who gave me vengeance and subdued peoples under me, who rescued me from my enemies. Yes, you exalted me above those who rose against me. You delivered me from the man of violence. For this I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations, and sing your name. Great salvation he brings to his king and shows steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his offspring forever. What does this leave us with? Let me give you 3 thoughts about this real quickly so that we can understand the attitude we ought to have toward ourselves, toward God, and then towards others as well. Number one, call on Yahweh. This is not a super complicated part of the psalm. Call on Yahweh. Whatever you face, it was created by God. The reason we get angry, the reason we're red-faced and screaming against the culture, the reason we fear, oh, what are we going to do? How are we going to oppose this? How are we going to defend ourselves? Is because we lack power or we lack trust. That's just the reality. That's where anger and fear come from, a lack of control. Well, if Yahweh created everything, the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything that's in them, then whatever it is we're facing, it was created by God, and believers have the ability then to know that God is in charge of it. That doesn't mean it's okay. I'm not saying that what God created, oh, it's just beautiful that I'm facing this crisis in my life. I'm not saying that. Death, for instance, is not a friend. It's the enemy. It's the last enemy to be defeated, as Paul says it in the letter to the Corinthians. It doesn't mean it's okay, but it does mean God can handle it. And so even if I don't personally have power, I know God does have power, and suddenly my anger and fear can subside. And I can be a person who calls out to the Lord and trusts him to put a broad place around me and give me a place to stand and to be steadfast. So I find peace. Number two, we humble ourselves before Yahweh. This sounds easy. It sounds like we're doing a great job of that. But the reality is we love to compare ourselves with people who don't measure up to our standards of one kind or another, whatever the standard is. I don't care if it's political or moral or just personal accomplishment or whatever you think it is. The reality is we're all under exactly the same judgment from God. That's why we hope, not in our power, but in God's refuge. That David's response to all of this isn't, oh, and look, I rose up and conquered these enemies on my own. No, I called out to God while I was bound in the grave, and he rescued me. And so we humble ourselves before God. He states very clearly, God delivers those who are humble. His humble people are the ones he delivers. Hope in humility, which puts our hope then in God's refuge. And finally, in the response of praise, I have talked about this recently as the mist that rises back up from the water that's on the ground. You know, when it's a warm day after it's been cold, and you see a steam or a fog that's coming off the lakes or whatever, that mist that's rising up is just returning water that's come down from the heavens before. And the reality is, this is what we do in response to God. We offer such a tiny portion back to him of anything he gives to us, but it's a really important part of what we do with him. After we call for help, we're supposed to remember to thank him for deliverance. And the only appropriate responses, the only appropriate mist to rise from us back to God would be these. Humility rises from us to meet the power that descends from heaven. Gratitude rises from us to meet the mercy that descends from heaven. If we are the believers God has called us to be, we will see others needing exactly the same thing we needed. We will lament at their losses in the same way David lamented over Absalom. But we will seek our refuge, not in our own power, not in our own expression of it. We will seek our refuge in Yahweh, who, by responding in power and mercy, will receive from us then our humility and gratitude.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.